Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. It's Chuck Coughlin. And you are listening to Breadbox Media. So this is part three of Columbus Shock. The largely unknown, or in some cases just underappreciated, history of Columbus, the true story of Columbus. A man who said to discover the New World, but actually just brought the Old World and New World together. It had already been discovered over and over again. And he didn't do it for gold or secular reasons. That was not the second or third, or maybe the fourth or fifth level reason. That financial asset, he intended to be 100% devoted to rescuing the land of the Holy Sepulchre from Muslim control, to take back Jerusalem and returning it to its Catholic and Christian heritage. His main reason was evangelization, the Grand Commission, to go forth and convert all nations, preaching the gospel and baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and of the Holy Ghost. In nomine Patris et Filii Spiritus Sanctus. That was his reason. It burned like a great flame within him. But we've just seen in the last program that Columbus was returned to Spain from Hispaniola in chains by an unjust judgment by Bombadilla, who had been made governor of Hispaniola, where there were problems. How was Columbus supposed to administer these disparate places? This was before the days of cell phones or the telegraph and communications, before the days of reliable or workable letters. If Columbus had always been present, the problems that occurred would not have occurred. They occurred because he was not present. In any case, he was brought back to the court of Ferdinand and Isabella in chains. They were horrified to see Columbus in chains, their great hero. The captain of the vessel that brought him had offered to remove the chains, but Columbus refused. His humiliation and his suffering, he wanted to be seen as a visible symbol. And Ferdinand and Isabella, they were realistic enough to know that Columbus could not continue to govern the Indies. To avoid offending him, they deliberately did not give the title of viceroy to anyone else, but they appointed another governor of the Indies. They restored the property that the former governor, Bombadilla, had confiscated, and removed Bombadilla as governor, but did not condemn Bombadilla's actions. With great diplomatic expertise, they resolved everything to everyone's satisfaction. They also restored one-tenth of revenues to which Columbus was entitled in their original agreement of 1492, which was considerable. And about this time, Columbus turned his attention elsewhere. In a way, elsewhere. He began writing his book of prophecies, the Book of Prophecies, his collection of biblical prophecies from the Old and New Testaments concerning the bringing of the gospel to distant land. The admiral's purpose in writing the book was to persuade the king and queen that these days that we lived in were the last days before the end of the world. He felt that maybe about 150 years were left. And the gospel must be preached across the world before the second coming. It was God's wish. And that God has chosen Columbus as his instrument to open these new lands to the word of God. The goal to be gained was to be used for a new crusade to free Jerusalem and the Holy Sepulchre from Muslim control, where they were persecuting Christians much as they are today. But as the year 1501 drew to a close, even though he was in failing health, Admiral Columbus began planning a fourth voyage. His purpose this time was to go beyond Hispaniola and find the continent of Asia. He still believed that that was feasible. So he asked for royal permission, which he promptly received. King and queen directed that he not go to Hispaniola, ostensibly because time would not permit, but actually because they knew his arrival would stir up more trouble. They did say he could visit Hispaniola on his way back if he chose. So, 1502, the next year, the admiral, his brother, Bartholomew, and his son Don Ferdinand, who was only 13 years old at that time, prepared the boat to sail. But just as they were ready to leave, the old crusader learned that the Moors had besieged the Portuguese fortress of Arzila in Morocco. He went to the defense of the Portuguese, but before he arrived, the Moors had been driven away. So the four vessels set their course westward across the Atlantic. Once again, they didn't have cell phones. Admiral Columbus headed straight for Hispaniola. Contrary to Ferdinand Isabella's wishes, ostensibly, he said, because one of their ships was having problems, and Columbus wanted to replace it. So they dropped anchor in Santo Domingo. He sent one of his captains ashore to buy another ship and to warn the governor that a hurricane was coming. The governor imperiously refused to let Columbus come ashore, said no ship was available, and dispatched a fleet of 28 ships to Spain. Columbus had warned him of an oncoming hurricane. He was ignored. Columbus, the wise sailor, sailed his four vessels into the mouth of a river, and the hurricane came upon them. The storm hit the larger fleet full force in mid-ocean. 24 of the 28 ships were destroyed, and over 500 people drowned, including the admiral's old enemy, Bombadil. We need not be surprised that the admiral's enemies maintained that he had raised the hurricane by sorcery, while his friends spoke of divine justice. Then Columbus led his expedition to the mainland, followed the course of Central America, southward, passing Honduras, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Panama. He was feeling so bad, his health was so bad, that he probably never went ashore. So he had a special cabin built on deck that he could lay there and observe the ocean. Then heading eastward, they were stranded on the coast of Jamaica for over a year. Shipwrecked on the coast of Jamaica, his body racked by pain. Listen to what was in his mind. Keep in mind that he did not know whether anyone would ever see this letter. And again, in his anguish, noticed how he trusts in God. Listen to Columbus. In January, the mouth of the river became obstructed. The vessels were all worm-eaten, and I could not keep them above water. At this time, the river cut a channel by which I brought out three empty ships with considerable difficulty. The boats went back into the river for salt and for water. The sea rose high and furious and would not let them out again.
There were many, many Indians who united and attacked them,
and in the end killed them. My brother and all of the rest of the people were living on board a vessel which lay inside. I was outside, very much alone on this rude coast.
I had a high fever,
feeling very fatigued. There was no hope of escape. In this state, I climbed painfully to the highest part of the ship and cried out for help with a fearful voice, weeping to your highness's war captains in every direction, but none replied. At length, groaning with exhaustion, I fell asleep and I heard a compassionate voice saying, "O fool, and slow to believe, and serve thy God, the God of every man. What more did he do for Moses or for David, his servant, than for thee? From thy birth he hath ever held thee in special charge. When he saw thee at man's estate, marvelous did he cause thy name to resound over the earth.
The Indies, so rich a portion of the world,
he gave thee for thine own, and thou hast divided them as it pleased thee. Of those barriers of the ocean sea, which were closed with such mighty chains, he hath given thee the keys. Thou wast obeyed in so many lands, and thou hast won noble fame from Christendom. What more did he do for the people of Israel when he carried them out of Egypt, for David, whom from a shepherd he raised to be king over Judea? Turn to him and acknowledge your faults. His mercy is infinite. Your old age shall not hinder you from performing mighty deeds, for many and vast heritages he holdeth." Abraham was past 100 when he begat Isaac, and Sarah was no young girl. You cry out for succor with a doubting heart. Reflect who has afflicted you so grievously and so often. Was it God or the world? The privileges and promises which God bestows, he does not take back. Nor does he say, after having received service, that this was not his intention, and that it is to be understood differently. Nor does he broadcast out suffering to make a show of his might. Whatever he promises, he fulfills with interest. That is his way. Thus I have told you what the Creator has done for you, and what he has done for all men. He has now revealed to me a portion of the rewards for so many toils and dangers you have borne in the service of others. Oh, Columbus was in touch with God, who he believed had given him the keys to the new world. And even while shipwrecked on the coast of Jamaica, and terribly ill, and listening to God's voice, and writing the words. This long letter continues. Listen to Columbus. Jerusalem and the Mount of Zion are now to be rebuilt by Christian hands. And God, through the mouth of the prophet in the 14th Psalm, said so. The abbot Joachim said that this man was to come from Spain. Saint Jerome showed the way to the Holy Lady. The Emperor of Cathay some time since sent for wise men to teach him the religion of Christ, Catholicism. Who shall offer himself for this mission? If our Lord takes me back to Spain, I will undertake to convey them there. Columbus and his crew were rescued after two crewmen used native canoes to travel to Hispaniola for help. Conviction of the immanence, the sovereignty, and the infinite wisdom of God, which transcended all his suffering and enhanced all his triumphs. Let's pause in our listening to Columbus and come back in a few minutes. Rest easy. This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. It's Chuck Coughlin. And you are listening to Breadbox Media. Christopher Columbus, the admiral of the ocean seas, is a man so vilified, slandered by modern historians, and so controversial even in his own day, that he deserves an audience. That's why Setting the Record Straight is giving him a voice, is listening to his words. I'm recreating his words, quoting him as much as possible. And we've discovered in part one of this multi-part series on Columbus that he's a devout Catholic, that his major reason for discovering the New World was evangelization. Was in order that these Aboriginal people not be denied heaven. And before the break, we heard Columbus writing the account of a voice he heard, presumably God's voice, charging him to continue on the mission of evangelizing all nations. It was a beautiful passage, but it was a long letter. He had time to reflect upon it as he composed it, because he was shipwrecked for a year on the coast of Jamaica, and very ill. Only 53 years old, old before his times. However, Columbus had reserved a little energy left over to write some sharp words about his critics. Listen to Columbus. Let us hear now from those who are full of blaming and find fault while they sit safely ashore. Why don't you do this, and why don't you do that? I wish they were on this voyage. I well believe that another voyage of a different kind awaits them, or our faith is for nothing. The admiral returned from his last voyage, in November 1504. He was only 53 years old, but broken in health and suffering from arthritis, gout, feverish deliriums. 19 days later, November 26, his heart was saddened by the death of his ally and true believer, Queen Isabella. In his last years, he set his affairs in order, received a substantial income from his interest in the Indies, though much less than he was promised, labored to secure his titles and positions for himself and his descendants, and still spoke of a crusade to Jerusalem. On May 20th, 1506, his condition suddenly grew worse. Surrounded by some of his most loyal captains and by his brother Diego and his sons Diego and Ferdinand, he received the Eucharist and the last rites, extreme unction. Then he passed away, his last words being, "In manatuis Domine, commendo spiritum meum. Into thy hand, Lord, I commend my spirit."
Christopher Columbus died and was buried, though there are aspects of the burial that remain as much of a mystery as many aspects of his life.
He was buried in Sevilla, in Spain, and King Ferdinand had an epitaph placed on his tomb. To Castile and León, Columbus gave a new world. Well, there's three ironies in that. First, Columbus never really knew he'd found a new world. He remained convinced that the Indies were off the coast of Asia. The second irony is that Columbus's body, his remains, may not be in Sevilla at all. Columbus' daughter-in-law requested permission to transfer his remains to the cathedral in Santo Domingo on Hispaniola, and supposedly this was done. Also buried in Santo Domingo were his son, his brother Bartholomew, and his two grandsons. It gets worse. When the French overran Hispaniola in 1795, Spanish authorities hastily removed the body and reburied it in Havana. Then, when Cuba became independent from Spain, the body of Columbus was moved again, this time back to Sevilla, in a marble tomb erected in his honor. So, it's in Sevilla. Or is it? Some researchers believe the body in the tomb in Sevilla is actually that of Diego Columbus. As of this writing, the final resting place of Columbus remains is still a mystery. There's one more irony, the third one. Is that Columbus remains as controversial in death as he was in life? In 1792, at the height of the French Revolution, whose partisans claimed to be pro-American, but really despise the true principles of liberty America stands for, the French Academy sponsored an essay contest on the subject. Has the discovery of the Americas been helpful or harmful to mankind? Well, one might ask, discovery by whom? Which time? Columbus was greatly honored in Spain and parts of Latin America, but in colonial America he was given little attention. Americans of that day showed little interest in the things of Spain. There's a lot of anti-Catholicism behind that, of course. American interest in Columbus began after the War for Independence. Washington Irving, who served as U.S. Ambassador to Spain, became fascinated with the life and deeds of Columbus. He wrote a famous and very readable work, The Life and Voyages of Christopher Columbus. And Columbus became an American hero. But today, Columbus bashers are determined to make him again into a villain.
For this Setting Record Straight program, for breadboxmedia.com, I've reduced the charges against Columbus, the negative publicity against Columbus, to 5 allegations, and we'll examine each one of them. 1, Columbus was an inept, a harsh, and unjust governor. The next, 2, Columbus was obsessed with gold. Number 3, Columbus had no right to claim the Americas for Spain. 4, Columbus made slaves of a free people. And 5, Columbus forced Catholicism and Western culture on the Native Americans. So let's examine them one by one.
And then we'll evaluate them and judge them. Let's look at them one by one.
Was our hero Christopher Columbus inept, harsh, and unjust as a governor? Well, okay, let's admit there's something to that.
The qualities that make a great sea captain do not necessarily make a good governor. Columbus left the colony for voyages of discovery and trips to Spain when he was needed in Hispaniola. Well, things got quite out of hand very quickly, and his attempts to restore order were seen as cruel and harsh. Now, Columbus would have undoubtedly been happier at his name in history, less blemished, if he had stayed just the Admiral of the Ocean Sea, but never Viceroy and Governor of the Indies. It's unfortunate that Ferdinand and Isabella didn't send him on further voyage of discovery and exploration, instead of sending him back to Hispaniola with 1,200 colonists. But that's the benefit of 500 years of hindsight. And this time we have a name for that. Monday morning quarterbacking. Now, in fairness to Columbus, it must be said he took on a difficult situation. A lot of those colonists that came to Hispaniola were hidalgos, Spanish gentlemen who did not want to do physical work, and looked down upon those who did, who came to the Indies to pick up their gold, get rich quick, and go back home to Spain. Others were convicted criminals, sometimes even sentenced to death, whose sentences were commuted on condition that they settle in Hispaniola. That's not the most promising material to begin with. And when we remember that they were thousands of miles from home, away from women of their own culture, dealing regularly with non-Christian natives, cut adrift from the civilizing influences of Spanish society, Catholic society, beset by disease and hunger and danger, and they didn't find the wealth they'd been promised. Well, we have to begin to understand why the situation got out of hand. Columbus had urged that only good Catholics be allowed to come to the Indies. If his advice had been followed, the result might have been quite different. Why don't we let Columbus speak for himself? Here's some of his words written while he was in chains on his way back to Spain. Keep in mind, they were the words of a great man who was a failed governor. They judged me there as a governor who had gone to Sicily or to a city or a town under regular government, where laws can be observed in toto without fear of losing all. And I'm suffering grave injury. I should be judged as a captain who went from Spain to the Indies to conquer a people numerous and warlike, whose manners and religion are very different from ours, who live in sierras and mountains without fixed settlements, and where, by divine will, I have placed under the sovereignty of the King and Queen, our lords, another world, whereby Spain, which was reckoned poor, has become the richest of countries. I ought to be judged as a captain, who for so long a time, up to the present day, hath borne arms without laying them down for an hour. And by knights of the sword, not men of letters, unless they were Greeks or Romans or others of modern times, of whom there are so many and so noble in Spain. For otherwise I am greatly aggrieved, since in the Indies there is neither a town nor a settlement. Well, he's being judged by a template that didn't fit the situation. That's my conclusion. What's yours? What do you think? What about Columbus's alleged obsession with gold? Well, that's not entirely untrue. There's such a motive. On island after island, when Columbus visited, he asked incessantly, where's the gold? He found some, but much less than he had expected and hoped. The great gold discoveries came later with Cortez in Mexico, in Pizarro in Peru. But let's get the issue in perspective. There's nothing wrong with wealth, is there? So long as it is acquired honorably, used responsibly, and valued in its proper perspective. The Bible does not say money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. But we really must break down if we're to keep proper account of things. So we'll do that. This is Chuck Coughlin, setting the record straight. Go to the website, breadboxmedia.com. There's gold in them there website. Care to share?
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. is Chuck Coughlin. And you are listening to Breadbox Media. Christopher Columbus, the admiral of the ocean seas, is a man so vilified, slandered by modern historians, and so controversial even in his own day, that he deserves an audience. That's why Setting the Record Straight is giving him a voice, is listening to his words. I'm recreating his words, quoting him as much as possible. Actually, this last part of this Setting the Record Straight program is a sort of trial, testing five allegations, very negative allegations, against the great Christopher Columbus. And we've just looked at the accusation that he was in love with gold. It appears that he was in love with what gold does, not gold itself. We said the Bible does not say that money is the root of all evil. No, it doesn't say that. Most often that's translated as the love of money is the root of all evil. As a matter of fact, the Greek says the love of money is a root of all evil. 1 Timothy 6:10. Columbus's reasons for seeking gold went beyond simply acquiring wealth for himself. First, the cost of his enterprise was substantial. A fleet of ships, provisions, and a crew that needs to be paid, typically with 6 months of pay in advance. To advance these costs, Columbus relied partly on private investors, partly on the crown. Just like the rationale we hear from modern CEOs of corporations. They have investors. They're compelled to turn a profit to the people who are trusting them with their money. Expect them to turn a profit, at least not to lose it. It would be only fair to think of Columbus as a CEO. He felt compelled to make the voyage this profitable for his investors. Otherwise, why would they ever do a thing like that again? With the royal treasury exhausted from the war in Granada, he was concerned that Ferdinand and Isabella might not be willing to support further voyages of discovery with more pressing local matters at hand, unless the voyages carried out the promise of profit. While he was selling to sell the first voyage to the royal court, he had spoken of the wealth of the Orient, and he felt compelled to deliver on that promise. The historian Madariaga suggests that Columbus may have misjudged the king and queen. They may have been more willing to subsidize the spreading of Catholicism than the admiral thought. But one can understand his concern. They did turn him down for years. For years. And of course, another matter is that Columbus wanted to be a rich man. Do you?
Well, do you?
Okay, I'll admit it. I do. Wealth for him does not appear to have been an end in itself, but rather a means to an end. Isn't it in your case? It is in mine. He wanted to be a world changer, an influential person who opens new worlds for the gospel and Western civilization. To Columbus, wealth meant influence. The third thing is, from the beginning to the end of his life, Columbus stressed his ultimate goal, bringing the Orient to Christ so that the Catholic lands of the earth could repel the advance of the Ottoman Turks and mount a new crusade to free Jerusalem from Muslim control. That's what it was all about, folks. Even more than voyages of discovery, wars and crusades cost money. Columbus repeatedly declared that the gold he discovered through his voyages was to be used to undertake this crusade to free the Holy Land. For those I-retire academics who are troubled by Columbus's desire for gold, let me offer a suggestion. Try thinking of it as a research grant. However, the admiral's attitude toward gold may become obsessive as time went on. I've seen this happen with dedicated Christian leaders and often with the best of motives. People who are ministers and priests focus upon their special work, and they equate their ministries with the advancement of God's kingdom. Now, that's obviously the way it's been done. Therefore, God must will the expansion of these priests and clerics' ministry. An end justify means mentality sets in without realizing it. And what do you think the main hindrance to the expansion of Christian ministries is? Usually, lack of funds. So is it wrong to conclude that that which brings in money for their ministries is the will of God, and that which doesn't isn't? This type of thinking, of course, is wrong and dangerous. It's kind of a trap that a dedicated Christian can fall into. It could be that Columbus was a bit influenced by this trap. On evidence, it doesn't really stick. It doesn't seem like Columbus. At least, that's what I think. What do you think about Columbus? Was he obsessed with gold? Doesn't sound like him to me. Well, the third thing was that Columbus had no right to claim the Americas for Spain. It's often been written that Columbus stole land from the natives and gave it to the crown. Did he? It seems self-evident, but still bears repeating, that one cannot steal something unless it belongs to someone else. So if we were to say that Christopher Columbus stole the Americas for Spain, whom did they belong to before? Well, we always say the Native Americans. But did they really own the land? A basic principle of international law is that for a nation to acquire new and undiscovered territory, three elements should coalesce. They must coalesce. One, physical discovery of the territory. Two, occupation with a claim of ownership. And three, actual, continuous, and peaceful display of the functions of government over the territory. Those people we now call the Native Americans were the first to physically discover America. They remained a permanent presence in the Western Hemisphere for thousands of years, it is said, although many of the tribes and nations migrated a great deal. And they came in waves and in dribbles. They didn't all come at once. Every day someone arrived. Every century a horde would arrive. But later waves eliminated the cultures that preceded them, like the Indian culture in Ohio that was eliminated 4,000 years ago by somebody who occupied that territory. The truth is, we're all Native Africans. We migrated out of Africa, evolved out of Africa. And it was not just one migration. It was a continual migration, every day for hundreds of thousands of years. So who are the natives? Well, we might say the people that are born here. Now we have a case. But these tribes migrated a great deal. So what was their contract? That they owned a certain piece of real estate? Did they exhibit an intent to claim ownership of the territory? And did they exercise an actual continuous and peaceful display of the functions of government over the territory? Many authorities maintain that Native Americans did not believe in or practice property rights in the sense the Europeans did. Neither tribes nor individual acquired permanent title to real estate. Rather, ownership was temporary and consisted of use. As long as you were using the land, it was yours. But when you ceased using it, anyone else was free to take it. Again, who owned the land prior to 1492? Did the Caribs own the island that bear their name? If so, how did they acquire those islands from the Arawaks? And who owned the islands before the Arawaks took them? In tracing titles and reverting to original ownership, how far back do you want to go? The European view of property, yes, was different. Land ownership was a matter of permanent title. Columbus certainly was not the first person to set foot on the island of San Salvador, but he may well have been the first person to set foot on San Salvador with the intent of claiming title for his nation. And there are such things as human rituals, traditional rituals, which form things like marriage bonds. One is claiming title to land. In Columbus and the Age of Discovery, the author Dornier gives an account of Columbus landing on San Salvador. So here we have the actual words of a historian, Dornier, D-O-R-N-E-R. Speaking of Columbus, he wrote, he erected a cross, quote, as a token of Jesus Christ our Lord, and concluded his ceremony of taking possession by naming the land San Salvador, Holy Savior. Thus Columbus claimed his discovery not just for Ferdinand and Isabella, but for the faith, the Catholic faith, to which they themselves were mere subjects. A Christian state had the absolute right to proclaim sovereignty over heathen and infidel domains. Earlier in that year of 1492, a similar prerogative had been exercised when the banners of Castile and Aragon went up over the Alhambra. Columbus, in a ceremony on the beach, was enacting a ritual that would be repeated hundreds of times as the great age of discovery unfolded. Protocols that would be followed wherever banners and crosses were displayed, in the names of distant sovereigns throughout the world. We have Cabot in Newfoundland, Cartier and Champlain in the St. Lawrence Valley, Henry Hudson in the New York Harbor, and Captain Cook in Polynesia. All these people acted out some variation of Columbus's right, R-I-T-E, setting the stage for a string of imperial struggles reaching down to the Falkland Islands War in our own day. And even when actual sovereignty is no longer sought, the outward forms still survive. Even on the moon, there's an American flag and a plaque signed by Richard Nixon. Such acts are potent symbols. If symbols like the American flag have no meaning, and oaths have no meaning, oaths to God have no meaning. If the symbols on the page that contains the U.S. Constitution has no meaning, then society collapses. Civilization collapses. Symbols are powerful. They proclaim the power of a nation and the will of its people, and mark the accomplishment that power and will provide. Now, don't miss one of these key points, a very key point. Yes, Columbus claimed San Salvador for Spain, but more especially for the Catholic faith and to the God to whom the Spanish rulers themselves were mere subjects. Without this understanding, the civilizations of Christendom collapse. And aren't we seeing a collapse of our civilization, of our structures, of our symbols? Aren't we? This is Setting the Record Straight, Taking a Break on Breadbox Media.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. It's Chuck Coughlin. And you are listening to Breadbox Media. You know, I wasn't joking a little bit earlier when I said, if you go to Bless the Yes on breadboxmedia.com, breadboxmedia.com, you're going to strike gold. Because there's a way to make money out of helping the station and this ministry, this global, transcultural, electronic media. This innovative, groundbreaking, ice-breaking, breadboxmedia.com. Help it. This is the way we're going to turn the world back again. It was by using the instrument of the media, of arts and the culture, that our world was corrupted and is causing its decay and gradual, spontaneous disassembling. We're going to uncorrupt it by going out of the cave by the same way we came in, by taking over the media, one channel at a time. And this is a very powerful channel. We have a purpose, a grand purpose. We need to spread the gospel to take back the world for Christ. And while we all are at this, I invite you to look at Care to Share and to participate in that. It will benefit you spiritually and financially. You need to eat. You need to have a home. You need funds. You can help support yourself with Care to Share. While doing God's work, just what Columbus was doing. Just before the break, we were talking about the responsibility of earthly rulers, who are Catholic rulers, that they're mere subjects of Christ, mere subjects of His church, the Catholic Church. So they're servants, they're servant leaders. They have responsibilities. And the responsibilities of administering the new colonies, the new Catholic colonies of the New World, fell to men that were sometimes not up to the duties and responsibilities that were required of them. Columbus was a great sea captain, not a great governor or administrator, but he might have been in an organized city that already had city codes and laws. He used the examples of the cities in Europe. If he had been governor of one of those, he might have done very, very well. When you're dealing with nomadic peoples, who have no concept of real estate law or the rule of law or territory that is possessed from generation to generation, administered fairly and without conflict, hopefully, under a civil rule of law. It's quite a different thing. Columbus, in attempting to be governor, of an area composed of primitive societies was attempting an almost impossible task. You're starting from ground zero. You're starting from home plate. You're starting from zero. So let's give him a break on it. I mean, who's up to that? Superman? Actually, somebody better than Superman. Who could do that and did it in South America in the Reducciones and did it superbly was the super being known as the Jesuit. They did it. The Jesuits did it magnificently, and working with the Guarani Indians produced the first 100% literate societies in the world. It took a Jesuit. I guess they weren't around. But back to Columbus, Ferdinand and Isabella, and the principles they were operating under, and the understandings. That included this. Catholicism teaches that civil rulers are established by God and act as his ministers or servants. Romans 13:1-7. One could argue, and should, that God had already provided the local chiefs to rule over these people. But rightly or wrongly, the Spanish believed they were extending the rule of God to lands that were hitherto outside his domain. And King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella did not view the discovery of the Indies as a land grab. Ferdinand and Isabella, as rulers, felt they had a responsibility. This new world, this Indies, this Hispaniola, and its human population and its natural resources were a responsibility, must be cared for. Responsibility that God had placed in their hands. So for Ferdinand and Isabella, conquest was not a title of sovereignty when the sovereign was not a Catholic or a Christian. This was as good as gospel truth in those days for all Christendom. In later times, ethics have degenerated since Christian princes spoil other Christian princes without qualms of any kind. In the circumstances, Ferdinand and Isabella considered the Indians as their subject and their responsibility, as a matter of fact, as a matter of real fact. On to allegation 4, that Columbus made slaves of a free people. Well, now, no question about it, slavery's wrong. Anything we can say in defense of the Spaniards on the slavery issue will be twisted, misquoted into a defense of slavery itself. So just so the record is very, very straight and clear and understood, and so no person will misinterpret me, let me say again, for the record, slavery is wrong. But the real issue is, does the existence of slavery prove that Columbus and company could not have been sincere Catholics? I suggest it does not. First of all, these tribes of Indians had each other as slaves. Slaves were numerous and abundant. Contrary to what is often alleged, the Spanish did not bring and introduce slavery into a world without it. A very much more wicked version of slavery was already here, and the Spanish Catholics suppressed that, as we shall see. Okay, secondly, Italy's enslavement of the native population does not appear to have been the explorer's original intent. When they first crossed the Atlantic, they expected to find not naked savages, but Oriental empires with size, wealth, and might equal to or surpassing their own. The goal was to win these nations for the Catholic Church and make them allies against the Muslim Turks. Slavery was not even thought about. That thought occurred much later, after the explorers saw the conditions of the natives. Third, slavery was widespread in the world of the 15th century. This does not make slavery right, but it does explain why Catholics might have accepted the practice. One is less likely to question a practice that has existed throughout the world from time immemorial, aren't they? Timothy Foote elaborates on this issue in a recent Smithsonian magazine. Here's part of what he wrote. Slavery existed everywhere, including the New World, though no one knew it yet, and Africa. The Turkish Sultan's whole army was made of his, and many of his administrators were his personal slaves. He used to raid the coasts of Europe, select all the best 10-year-old boys, made the best army in the world. They were called the Janissary Guard. Of course, they were forcibly converted to Muslims, and the brightest of them became his great administrators. All his civil servants were European boys who had been stolen and bound into slavery and made to be Muslims. And there is no escape hatch from Islam other than death. Arab traders working West Africa brought back 4 million slaves for the Middle East alone. The cruelty and expansion of slavery in the New World seems more reprehensible, however, precisely because in 15th century Europe, slavery was forbidden. It was relatively rare and getting rarer. This was because Catholicism taught the manumission of slaves, in other words, the freeing of slaves, was pleasing to God. Oh, and another reason is because peasants were more efficient than slaves in the agricultural economy. The fourth factor is that by the ethics of the day, Catholics could not enslave other Catholics, but it was considered proper to enslave non-Christians who were taken in battle as prisoners of war, and they were often later released. Now, Muslims practiced a similar ethic, and during the Crusades in the 15th century, Catholic and Moor struggles in Spain, it was common for each side to enslave defeated captives from the other side. Catholics were not allowed to enslave other Catholics, but many city families might have had one slave or two. And these people found it relatively easy to marry or to work their way to freedom. They were acquired as pagan, usually in Eastern Europe, and baptized to save their souls only after they were in service. The fifth thing is European Christians believed their right to enslave pagans applied only to those defeated in battle. Those who surrendered were allowed to keep their freedom. The warlike Arabs were generally considered in the former category, the peaceful Arawaks in the latter. So in our trial today on setting the record straight, if you leave the judgment to me, I declare Columbus is not guilty of these charges. If asked his greatest failing, Columbus might echo the words he wrote while facing hardship in the Indies in the 1500s. Listen to Columbus. Unhappy sinner that I am to have placed all my hopes in the things of the world. That's what he thought. Perhaps it is so. Columbus depended too much upon himself and overestimated his personal importance in the plan of God. Maybe. It's hard to tell. There's justification for thinking he was right. I entitled this program Columbus Shock because his devotion and his Catholicism animated everything he did. That was the reason he did what he did, his Catholicism. Perhaps he looked too much for recognition from men, and his failure to get the recognition that was due him prevented him from fully experiencing the joy that comes from being used of God in his plan. But his heart was with God, and God used him mightily. He had a deep conviction of the eminence, the sovereignty, and the infinite wisdom of God, which transcended all his suffering and enhanced all his triumph. Don't feel sorry for him. He enjoyed long stretches of pure delight, such as only a seaman may know, and moments of exaltation that only a discoverer can experience. I wish the Columbus might have been afforded a sense of fulfillment that would have come foreseeing all that flowed from his discoveries, that would have turned all the sorrows of his last years into unbounded joy. The great shock to me of reading what Christopher Columbus actually thought was how different he was than the common misconception so negative of the man. What better motivation than to save souls? To ensure a path to heaven for two continents of people who came to Christ largely through his voyage and his setting his foot there on the sands at San Salvador. This is Setting the Record Straight on Breadbox Media. I'm a shocked Chuck Coughlin and very pleased.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.